This shiur has been brought to you from the Sharim Audio Library. For information about Sharim or to order additional CDs, please visit our website, www.sharim.com, or email sharim@sharim.com. Thank you for making Sharim part of your continual learning experience.
I'm just pointing out right now that you should know that it is an absolutely integral part of the Torah itself. It's just the hidden part. It's the hidden part of the Torah. But the point I'm trying to make is that you see how even in what looks like the most difficult times, the Jewish people is continuing to flourish and produce these tremendously inspiring works. Yeah, and this is, you see, that this is the greatness of the Jewish people. How, and this is a phenomenon that goes on and on and on and on. And in the worst times, the Jewish people are never abandoning the Torah, never abandoning expanding the Torah, developing the Torah, explaining the Torah, donating the Torah. This, and really, in my opinion, this really shows not only Hashem's kindness and chesed to the Jewish people, but it also shows so abundantly the greatness and the tenacity. The Jewish people. Yeah.
Yes. Is it true that the Kabbalah can be dangerous?
If a person is not ready for it yet.
Yeah.
Okay? If a person is not ready for it. Today, by the way, it just says that it's Be'elech HaShishi, this is the sixth millennium, it says Niftachu Ma'in Sechof. Wellsprings of wisdom. This is said in Zohar, that wellsprings of wisdom are going to be opened up in the sixth millennium. We're living in the sixth millennium. I am convinced that what you look at, you look in the last century, the technological boom of the last century, we just take it for granted. But a phenomenon like that, where the world is just, there's just been an exponential explosion of knowledge which exceeds anything that ever happened before, I believe it is a supernatural phenomenon, the power of this phenomenon, that the wellsprings of knowledge and wisdom will be opened up towards the end of the hour. She just explains right now why today is becoming interesting in Kabbalah, widespread, that there wasn't in previous generations. So Pinchas explained this is also part of this phenomenon. Yeah, so did you want to ask something?
Yeah, I was just wondering, was this knowledge here until then?
Yeah, Rabbi Shimon did not make it. As a matter of fact, all the Torah that we have, that's something we're going to mention today as we go on. The entire Torah, every single part of it was given to Moshe. Okay? Every part. Chazal tells us, even told Moshe, even all of the Chidushim that were ever going to be come up in the course of. This is an axiomatic, by the way. Everything comes to contain within these words. Rabbi Shimon, it actually, there is, even this, there's controversy over this. Some actually assert that the Zohar was actually written in the Middle Ages. However, the accepted mainstream view is that it was. Rabbi Shimon didn't actually write it down. He gave over the teaching, and his son, Rabbi Elazar, wrote it down. That's essentially the mainstream.
A friend of mine asked to Rabbi Tatz some of the stuff that he teaches. Is it not like you're telling us Kabbalah stuff that we're not really meant to know? And the answer that my friend got from Rabbi Tatz was like, this isn't Kabbalah, this is the stuff that like 100 years ago every kid knew on the street.
Rabbi Tatz is a Talmud of someone called Moshe Shapiro. And Moshe Shapiro is extremely deep thinking. And there's no question about it that a lot of it is Kabbalistically oriented. Okay?
I know nothing about Kabbalah. And people who know things about Kabbalah will deny it, and I know absolutely nothing. And they're like, right.
Anyway, I just want to point that out. Okay, that's really talking about the Kabbalah is not really our topic today, but I just think that's what came up. Now, there was another great light that was about to emerge from Jewish people in this time. And before we discuss that, though, we have to talk about the person who's going to bring that light out into the people. And this is a person called Rabbi Yehuda. Okay? This is going to be one of the most obvious examples of Hashkocha Pratis, divine providence. We actually mentioned it in the Gemara that actually speaks about. about it, the birth of this towering individual. I mean, we're talking about, you know, it's hard to talk about someone being so towering in a generation of giants, and they're all giants. That really, really was a very exceptional person who was sent into the world for a very exceptional task. And that's what we're going to speak about today. Okay? So that's the introduction today. Today we're going to the topic of today's discussion, Spirit of Being Ready. He's called, his name was Rebbe Yehuda. I mentioned before that remember when Hillel came from Babylon 100 years before the destruction, the position of Nazi was given as a hereditary part, was given as a hereditary gift to his family. His son was Shimon, and his son was Gamliel. But from then on, everyone was either called Shimon or Gamliel. They switched on and off. Rebbe Yehuda was the first exception. His name was Yehuda. Okay, so he was Rebbe Yehuda, the son of Rabbi Shimon of Gamliel. We'll discuss that today. Okay? And he is known by the Jewish people as two terms. He's either called Rebbe, he's called our teacher. Okay, so Rebbe is singled out for the discussion, for the title, as the universal teacher of the Jewish people, which is a very rare distinction, or is also called Rabbeinu HaKodesh, our holy teacher. He's called, this term is given because Rebbe Yehuda, notwithstanding that he was a very wealthy person, and he conducted his position as Nazi with great majesty, he never took any of the pleasures for himself. Everything he did was only in order to give honor to his position as Nazi, for the well-being of the people. It says that, well, actually the truth is maybe I'll get to a minute why he was called Rebbeinu HaKodesh. I'll come back to this in a minute, okay? Alright, but we'll get to this in a bit. And we're going to see that he's going to make an absolutely immortal contribution to the Jewish people. It's called the mission. Okay? Rebbe's going to bring us the mission. Okay? That's another part of it. So where we left off was let's first of all see what's going on in the Roman world. In the year 161 CE, the Roman Emperor Antoninus Pius died, and he was succeeded by his son-in-law, a man called Marcus Aurelius. Aurelius, okay? It's Marcus, you know how to spell. Aurelius is A-U-R-E-L-I-U-S. Okay? He, in Jewish terms, is called Antoninus. If you look at all the Jewish sources, we refer to him as Antoninus. He became Antoninus, actually Rashi even refers to him in the Chumash. But Antoninus was a very, very exceptional person. Okay? He was called the philosopher king. He was an extremely wise person. He was a philosopher. He was a superior person in every single way. He was, without question, the greatest of all of the Roman emperors. Okay? He was really top quality stuff.
Mm-hmm. What year are we in?
161 CE. 161 CE. Okay? Now this is going to be an absolutely turning point of the Jewish people. Rashi in the Chumash, at the beginning of Pashas, told us, says that when Rivka Imena became pregnant, she had a very trying pregnancy, and she went to the Navi to find out what was going on, and the Navi said, Shnei Goyim Bevitnech, Shnei Geim. It says Geim, two great people. Geim is distinguished great people are in your stomach. Rashi says, this is, Rashi's not making it up, Rashi's quoting the Medrash. This is referring to Rebbe and Antoninus. One is descended from Esav, one is descended from Yaakov, of course. But these are these two, they're already hidden right at the beginning. Antoninus, we're going to see, was a person who was going to be in a way Rebbe's partner. We're going to see what he actually brought about. He was the most distinguished and the greatest of all the Roman emperors. And actually, I saw there's a sefer called Menorah Samaor, which is a medieval sefer, quite a famous one. It brings down that Antoninus, when he was a baby, was nursed by Rebbe's mother. Okay? And then maybe there's some significance in this. Maybe I'll just say in parentheses. My grandmother came to Australia. I mean, my grandmother passed away a few years ago. She's nearly 100 years old. So she must have come to Australia, I think, at least 105 years ago. Right? And she told me that there was a non-Jewish woman, a neighbor there, and this woman, every single one of her children died in infancy. And one of the children, one of them, my great-grandmother, my grandmother's mother, nursed this child, and it was the only one of which, the only child this woman had lived. I wouldn't be surprised. I never checked it out. But I wouldn't be surprised if this person came again. I can't be sure. Okay? Anyway, it says that Antoninus was nursed by Rebbe's mother. We'll see what. But just put that one aside. That's a ticket. Okay, let's go on. So what happened was, Antoninus, he was a warrior, he was a philosopher. He, again, we mentioned before that all the way over in the east is what they call the Parthian Empire, Persian Empire, and the Romans, he renewed the war against the Parthian Empire. Yeah, these were traditional enemies, the Romans and the Parthians. So let's say what Persia is. You can call it Persia, makes it easier. Okay? So really had to, if in order to get there, you have to go to where it's yourself to get there. So he realized that he needed to somehow use Erzurum as a bridge to get through. This is something that other Roman emperors had also been confronted with. So how do you approach this? How do you get the goodwill of the Jews? So until now, his predecessors always used the Roman approach, which is smashing things. He actually was a little bit more tactful, and he actually tried to mollify and to befriend the Jews. He actually, part of his war campaign, in 163, he came to Erzurum, and there he met Rebbe. Okay? In other words, 2 years after he'd become the emperor, he met Rebbe, and when he was in Erzurum, I made a mistake with the dates. In 163, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel died, and Rebbe received his son Rebbe Yehuda at the age of about 36. That's the date 163. And about 2 to 3 years later, Antoninus and his war, and his part of his campaign, and his way to Parthia came to Eretz Yisrael. And he met Rebbe, and then at that point, the two of them formed a very firm friendship. And this is going to be an absolutely turning point for the Jewish people. This friendship between Rebbe and Antoninus. As a matter of fact, it says in the Medrash that Antoninus was so taken with Rebbe, so impressed with the wisdom of the Torah, that he actually became a secret convert. And he remained as emperor. And what was going to be of particular significance for us is that throughout Antoninus' life, and also through the life of his son, he was succeeded by his son called Commodus, they remained a very friendly conciliatory attitude towards the Jews because they're friendly with Rebbe, and this is going to facilitate a very, very, very important stage in Jewish history. It could be regarded as nothing less than a godsend. Okay? So it comes out of this that Rebbe, that Antoninus came and was very impressed by this fraternity. He was extremely impressed with Rebbe and everything that Rebbe represented. By the way, we just mentioned in the last class, right, that how sometimes through great people, you can see Hashem through great people. I wouldn't be surprised if Antoninus, he saw the light of Hashem in the person of Rebbe. He was captivated by it. Okay? Alright. So Rebbe was given a privilege that was taken away from his father. Remember the Romans, what happened was that the Romans were afraid of letting any Jew have too much power in his hands. So even though they let Rebbe's father, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, they allowed him to be the Nasi, the official head of the Jewish people, but they wouldn't allow him to be also simultaneously the head of the Sanhedrin. They didn't want too much authority on one person. However, while in this new period, Rebbe actually occupied both positions. He was both the Nasi, which gave him political power, and was the acknowledged political head of the Jewish people, with powers to collect taxes and the like, right? And he was also the head of the spirit of the Sanhedrin, which also made him, so to speak, the spiritual leader, and a question the spiritual leader of the Jewish people as well. So he would have one person all of the qualities, concentrate all of the powers in the hands of an exceptionally great person. Okay, so we'll find that the Romans actually honored Rebbe so much that they granted him very considerable tracts of land, and actually Rebbe became very, very wealthy. So you know what's happened? After decades of destruction and turmoil and suppression, he've got the Roman Empire recognizing the most eminent Jewish sage, Rebbe Yehuda Anossi, and enriching him. Rebbe has reached this power of ultimate authority. So obviously, you can imagine, it was a very high time that Rebbe was an exceptionally great and unique figure. not only respected by the Romans and the Roman Emperor, but all of the sages and all of the people, that it was universally looked up to him, admired him, and respected him. It's obviously an example of Hashgacha, that such a person should have emerged at such a time. Okay? Really, you would say that the emergence of such a person at such a time, when you remember all of the turmoil we've had the destruction of the temple. 20 years later, we've had the widespread annihilation of Jewish communities all over the world. 30 years after that, the Bar Kokhba uprising. Yeah? After that, we have the destruction of Beit Har, the destruction of the entire Judea. Right? We've had the killing of the Rabbi Akiva and the 10 Sarayrugi Malchus. Right? For the Jewish people to get up in a situation like this is absolutely beyond comprehension. And the fact that a person should emerge at this stature of Rebbe and should be universally recognized and even enriched, not only by the Jews, but by the non-Jews as well, is a phenomenal miracle. The truth is, I want to just read you a little Gemara here. It's a very important principle to understand over here. The Gemara says, there's a pasuk in the Chumash that says, the first prophet says, V'loi ma'astim, V'loi ge'altim, L'chaloysim, L'hafiyas b'risim. The pasuk says there, I have not rejected them, I have not turned away from them to destroy them or to undo my covenant with them. In other words, Hashem is talking over there that even this is in Parshas Bechukei, which describes the rebuke that Hashem gives to the Jewish people, but he says, notwithstanding all of the punishments that have come, Hashem has promised he's never going, no matter what happens, he will never abandon the Jewish people. No matter what happens. Okay? And there are four expressions of here. The expression says, Lo Ta'astim, I have not rejected them, Lo Ge'altim, and turned them away, Chaloysim, to destroy them, in order to take away my bris with them. So the Gemara says like this. How does the Gemara dash in this pasuk? You interpret this pasuk. It says, Lo Ma'astim, I didn't reject them. This refers to the days of the Greeks. The next word, I didn't turn away from them. This was in the days of my time. Just if I'm reading the right place. Yeah, one second. Yeah. This was in the days. This way. When I asked him, because over here, I never rejected them. This is going on the days of the Babylonians. Yeah, when the Jewish people were in exile in Babylon, that I provided for them the meal. Hananiah and Mishael, Azariah, four great tzaddikim who guided the generation of Jews in the exile in Babylon. Lo Ge'altim, I didn't turn away from him. This is in the days of the Greeks when I produced Shimon HaTzaddik and the Hashmonoim and his sons. Yeah? The Chaloysim, to destroy them. This is in the days of Haman when I provided for them Mordechai and Esther. And I didn't deny my covenant with them. This is in the days of the Romans when I brought Rebbe. And the sages of subsequent generations. In other words, like this. We see that Hashem has made a promise never to abandon us. And this promise is manifest in the fact that great individuals have been present to lead and to guide the Jewish people. Right? In the worst crisis, one of these people is Rebbe.
What's the source?
It's Tractate Megillah 11a. Okay? I read your Gemara. Okay? But do you want to look it up or not? That's your problem. Okay? Okay?
I have a question that's slightly off topic. If that's the interpretation of that verse, then what if we need someone
after it? So not. First of all, that's what's called a drash. As you know, there are different levels of understanding the Torah. There's kind of chat, there's drash, right? There's sod, and all of these things, parties, called parties. So this is just a drash. And other people drash, there are others who say, and read you one part of it, they interpret it differently. I interpret this as meaning that this is not limited to that generation. It's just showing you that when we see that the great Jews appear, throughout all generations, when the Jewish people were threatened by all kinds of crises, the Hashem's way of looking after them is by bringing forth very great individuals, but that's Hashkocha. The Hashem has never abandoned us. That's what it was. I don't think it's limited only to the people who I mentioned over here. This is an ongoing phenomenon, but I do want to point out But Rabbi Yehuda Arnossi, the person we're talking about over here, is in the honor list over here. And he was the Hashem's emissary in this time over here in the time of the Rav. So it says over here that perhaps in a way, this is also, I think this is also part of a phenomenon. I think this type of, personally now I am, this is what I'm saying right now is, what's the word I'm looking for? It's, I'm surmising that we find very, very often in the course of Jewish history that after a tremendous crisis, a period of suffering, there is a love, there is a period of grace. Okay? This is something which a phenomenon which we see many, many times in Jewish history, that after tremendous upheaval, Hashem, so to speak, expresses rachamim and gives the time of tranquility. So in Rebbe's time, this was, you have to say, there have been since the time of the destruction of the temple to the time we're starting right now, it's about 150 years. It's a period of, well, maybe that's a bit, you know, it's a bit, there are different opinions. We'll say, one's held 120 years, 150 years. We're talking more than, it's more, been more than a century of almost utter chaos and unbelievable suffering of the Jewish people. And then comes this moment of tranquility. Okay? And this is the period that the Rebbe presides over. Okay? I happen to personally think that that's the time we're living in right now as well. In other words, the period after the Holocaust, there's a lull after the storm. Okay? We better get our act together, because I don't think it's historically realistic to think it's going to continue like this forever. Okay? Right. Okay. So, you have the situation, man, that really. The difference is that what this period of grace, this moment of tranquility, actually was used by Rebbe actually to produce one of the most outstanding and one of the most essential works that will preserve the Jewish people. In other words, Rebbe utilized the opportunity. Just like if Hashem gives us a period of grace, we have to understand that we have to utilize it and not abuse it. Okay? Rebbe actually utilized it, and he foresaw that the Jewish people, this was really perhaps, and again, this was the lull, but he saw that from now on will be a period of decline, and he has to prepare the Jewish people. He has to prepare the Jewish people for a long, bitter exile, and he's going to produce a work that we're going to discuss today called the Mishnah. This will be the last universally accepted great work that's going to be produced by the sages of Eretz Yisrael, right? After Rebbe, we're going to see that the focus of the Jewish world is actually going to move away from Eretz Yisrael, it's going to move to Babylon, it's going to become the center of Jewish life in Eretz Yisrael is not going to disappear just yet. Rebbe, the position of Nasi is going to linger on for about at least another 200 years, all the way through the descendants of Rebbe. However, the entire topic today, especially when we see in the mid-300s, when the Roman Empire became Christian, this was really the death knell for the community, and the Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael, because then once the Roman Empire became Christian, then the animosity that the church had towards the Jewish people and the Torah had the full backing of the whole empire, and it culminated in the middle of the 400s when the position of the Nazi was finally terminated, and Eretz Israel is going to basically, unfortunately, be for the next 1,000 years pretty much the backwater in Jewish life. But before this happens, in other words, the downward trend is already going to begin after Rebbe passes away, but before he does, he's going to produce something exceptionally great, and that's the Mishnah. That's what I want to discuss today. Okay? Yeah. Can someone want to say something? All right. Now, I want to tell you something about the Mishnah. Okay? The Rambam says, the Rambam wrote a long introduction to the Mishnah, and in his introduction, the Rambam says like this. I'll read it. This is only part of it. It's very long. He says, every commandment given in Sinai was given with its explanation. In other words, this is part of our belief that the entire Torah was given to was given by Hashem to Moshe Rabbeinu, and it was given in its completeness, right? The explanation of everything was given. The command, the written commands, the written Torah was given, you know, obviously in a written form, and it was given with every single explanation. But these explanations, it's called the oral Torah, and this was given orally down from generation to generation. This is how we start Pirkei Avos. It says Moshe, Kibel, Torah Misinai, and the Sar, the Yeshua, Yeshua the Zakenim. The Zakenim, Hashem, Mr. Sagbelo, right? The men of the Great Assembly. And they passed it down one generation after another. Every single generation received the Torah in its entirety. Now, I don't know if you know what that means. That means the entire body of an oral and written Torah with every single detail. And we went from Moshe until Rebbe was 36 generations, right? Or 36 generations from Moshe Rabbeinu until Rabbeinu HaKadosh, 36 generations. Each generation, the head of each generation, would receive Kol HaTorah Kula. Okay? So it says over here that so everything was given down, it was an authoritative tradition for everything. This is an important point that a falsification had crept in, as if the sages actually created the oral Torah. This is a mistake. They were merely the receptacles of the oral Torah. If there was something that was not clear, or we didn't have a tradition for it, then the sages had what were their certain things, something called the 13 principles by which the Torah is interpreted. This is also something that was given at Sinai, and they were given the ability to make to interpret according to the principle, these 13 principles. If any dispute came up, then what they would do is when you had a Sanhedrin, the Sanhedrin would sit down and they would take the vote, and there would be one solid, consistent corpus, comprehensive corpus of moral law. Okay? Now, the oral law had to be, obviously, oral. Okay? So much so that the Torah says, the Gemara actually makes that mention difference. It says that the makes interpretation that actually you're not allowed to even write it down. It had to be learned orally. But whatever was that, it's true that when the sages were allowed to keep their own personal, were allowed to write it down for their own personal records. When they wrote things down, it was called Megillah study. Megillah study means a hidden Megillah. They had to keep it strictly for themselves. The tradition they would pass on to their students was oral. Now, what's the reason for this? What's the reason for having two Torahs? So, one of the explanations I saw is that to master the written Torah is not so difficult. I mean, it's very difficult for us. Certainly for them, it was not so difficult. The oral Torah, to understand and to comprehend it, is extremely difficult. And part of it is based on the idea of a tradition from teacher to Talmud, teacher to Talmud, teacher to Talmud. It has to go down in this way. It has to go in the format of what we call a Masoret, a tradition. This idea meant that learning it was not something that a person could just do as an intellectual exercise, but it meant years and years and years and years of very close contact with the teachers of the previous generation. So it comes out that now, knowing the Torah, it cannot be ever understood without the idea of a clear tradition and what we call a Masorah, passing on from one generation to the next. In other words, the students have to be schooled, not only in the information, they have to be personally instructed and learn the lessons, life lessons, and character lessons of their great teachers. Okay? That's one reason. By the way, there's a separate reason. It's also discussed that this oral nature of the Torah is that the Torah actually is what we call the bris, the covenant between Hashem and the Jewish people. Okay? Actually, we'll learn that in this week's parasha. Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu, and Yisrael says that Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu, this will be our bris, this will be our covenant. And idea of a bris, so to me, the covenant, the idea of a bris is something which is exclusive. You know what I mean? Exclusive? These two people are in, and everybody is out. Okay, that's what this means. And it's interesting that when the Torah was actually translated into Greek in the Second Temple period, actually this was a precedent for the non-Jewish world to say that the Torah actually was theirs. I mentioned once. You know, we know that in the time of the Greeks, the Greek king was then in Egypt actually commissioned the translation of Torah into Hebrew. Okay? From that time on, the non-Jewish world would have now had the Torah in their language. So they made various translations to various languages. And in the course of time, they actually laid claim to it, saying that the Torah was theirs. In other words, this was this idea that the Jewish people had lost their position. They had inherited the mantle of the Jewish people. So much so that I heard that when they changed over in England, they changed over from the King James Bible to the New English Bible, right, the edition. I heard that they interviewed a non-Jewish woman in the street. They asked her, what did she think about changing over from the King James Bible to the New English Bible? So she said, her words were, she said, the King James is good enough for Moses, it's good enough for me.
What is
it? Huh? No, this was a different translation. Okay, the edition. Okay. She said, the King James is good enough. She said, the King James is good enough for Moses, it's good enough for me. Okay?
It wasn't even good enough
for you. Okay.
But anyway. Like from Hebrew to Greek to Latin to
whatever, yeah. So because of which there are so many metamorphoses, it became completely, in the course of time, it became completely distorted. And actually, after a while, there was almost no comparison to no life.
It's very
epistemic.
Huh? It's very explicitly.
Okay. All right. Anyway, so the idea was that we see that they incorporate, they call it the Old Testament, as we all know, and it's part of their Bible as well. What remained, however, what remained that expressed the uniqueness of the Torah is the unique preserve of the Jewish people. This was preserved from the Torah Shabbat, the oral Torah. This was something which is, and I put the points out, this is something which part of the Ashkocha is, and this is something that the non-Jews were never able to master, never able to understand. But the idea was that it was an oral tradition, that means that you had to learn the Torah until it was in your kishkas. You understand what I'm saying? When you have to learn something orally, that means that you have to have extremely close contact with your teacher. You have to learn with it for many, many, many years. It cannot be learned without an instructor. And it has to be learned in a certain framework, and when you master it in that form, it becomes part of your being. You understand? Can you imagine if you have to learn everything, absolutely everything about it, everything orally? If this was the way it was, and it's so much so that it was actually prohibited. It was a prohibition to write the oral Torah. In other words, you could keep your own personal notes, but the transmission of the Torah had to be oral. Okay? So therefore, it meant that it was a direct, in every case, there was a direct transmission from generation to generation. Okay. Came along Rebbe, and he made a radical departure from this tradition. And I'm sorry, if I said 36 generations before, I see now it's 34 generations. For the first time, he was the 34th generation to receive the entire Torah, including the entire oral tradition. And Rebbe wrote down, compiled, edited, and wrote down the oral Torah in the form of the Mishnah. Okay? Now, how did Rebbe do it? There's a pasuk in Tehillim. The pasuk says, "Esa asos Hashem, it has a kama time to do for Hashem a fear to yourself, to, so to speak, almost to undo the Torah." Sometimes there are certain people. Now, this is obviously a very risky principle, and only the very greatest people could ever assume to do such a thing. It's not for people like you and me. But certain people, certain highly inspired people, and you see, Rebbe has spoken over his reference over here that he's one of the agents for the salvation of the Jewish people. Rebbe saw that it was necessary to actually write down make a concise form of the oral Torah and put it down in the form of the Mishnah. He saw that after all of the tzaras, all of the persecution, all of the scattering, all of the dispersion, all of the hardship of the Jewish people, the dwindling numbers of Talmidim, and the fact that the Jewish people are becoming increasingly scattered, if he doesn't do it now, then Chas v'Shalom could become forgotten. Okay? So, this is what Rebbe did, and Rebbe compiled the Mishnah. And what Rebbe did was, the Kuzri says that what Rebbe did in compiling the Mishnah took a period of 60 years. It says that it's something which is not humanly possible to do. He mastered in order to do it. Yeah. First of all, no one of any less stature the Rebbe could have done it, because nobody else would have listened to him. In other words, only a person of absolutely unquestioned greatness could have done something so radical to actually commit the oral Torah to writing. But it requires a person to have a total mastery of the entire oral tradition, everything that's been accumulated over 34 generations. It's absolutely stupendous. Okay? So Rebbe made this radical break with the oral tradition. He gathered together all of the Mishnayos, which is the basic Tamsis. Tamsis is the concentrated form of statement of the halacha, is written down extremely concise, extremely terse. Right? You can have, I'll show you in a second how it looks in a copy of the Gemara. But what did Rebbe do? Rebbe had to collect all the entire body of oral law. He had to verify exact wording. He had to establish internal organization within the Mishnah, and he had to organize it and write it down. He had to say what to put in, what to leave out, how to express it, how to write it down, right? And then he had to discuss, teach, and disseminate, and secure its acceptance. Now again, nobody less than Rebbe could have done such a thing. And it comes out that what we have now is, what we see today is, let's take an example. We mentioned before, I'll give you an example. This is Tractate Megillah. So I don't know if you can see here. This is how it works right now. We have here, this is the first Mishnah in the second Megillah. And the Mishnah goes from here to here. Then afterwards it's got the letters Gimel Mem, which stands for Gemara. What happened with like this? Rebbe, he wrote down the Mishnah in such a way that, remember, the Torah is meant to be, the oral Torah is meant to be adapted through an oral tradition. He wrote it down in such a way that it wouldn't be forgotten, but the only way to properly understand it is still only if you have a proper instruction and connection with the teacher of previous generations. Do you understand what I'm saying? He wrote it down in a sufficiently concise way that it would not be forgotten. Simultaneously, it would maintain its uniquely oral tradition. Because I'll say that a person who, even if a person can sit down and read all of this, a person who, it's in the Gemara, says that a person who learned all of the oral Torah but didn't get it, wasn't instructed by Talmidei Chachamim from a previous generation, even if he knows the whole thing, he's called an Amoritz, it's called an Ikaranus. Yeah, like that. A person can know the whole thing. But if you weren't a Sham of Talmidei Chachamim, if you didn't learn it through an instructor, you're a godless Ikaranus. That's what the Gemara says. Okay? So what you have then is, because it was written down in such a concise way, that there was still a massive body of teaching to try to explain every single mission. That's why you have, for example, here, what you have, and later on, this is going to come a couple hundred, 300 years later, you have what we call the Talmud, which is based on the mission. So what we call today the Talmud, here, this is Talmud Bavli, this is the Babylonian Talmud. How is it formed? You start with the Mishnah. And then you have afterwards, when you finish the Mishnah, you have the Gemara. The Gemara is an elaboration of all of the things discussed in the Mishnah. Sometimes it goes on for pages and pages and pages and pages discussing the Mishnah, and we go all the way up until here. Let's discuss it. We've had six full pages discussing one Mishnah. Even the Gemara itself is extremely concise.
And then we wouldn't even understand the Gemara if we tried to.
That's right, and that's why in every generation, that's why Hashem, you know what Hashem did? Hashem sent us Rashi. And then afterwards, Hashem said, "That's Tesis." Extremely honored to be added to such a hall of fame. But I don't know that if I would get a job as a tea lady over there. It's such an academy. Okay, I'm singularly honored that I have the privilege to learn what they have to say. But all I want to say is like this, this idea that the Mishnah, comprising the Mishnah, wants something that he accepted. The Gemara says that since the time that Hashem, the temple was destroyed, and the HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the Dalad HaLashem HaLachet Bavad. At Torah, where did Hashem put his Shekhinah after there was no more? Where was Hashem's Shekhinah after the temple was destroyed? It remains within the four cubits of the Torah itself. It says from the time the Torah, the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, Hashem doesn't have a place in his world except within, it's called Dalad Amas, the four cubits of Halacha. Halacha means what's discussed in there, what's discussed in the Gemara. The oral tradition, the Mishnah, which fused later on with the Talmud, which develops and expounds on the ideas of the Mishnah, this, more than anything else, is the life force and has sustained the Jewish people in all generations. Okay? The Gemara says that Hashem, when He made His covenant with the Jewish people, the covenant was made through the oral Torah. That's what it says. That bridge, that covenant, that's why the study and the knowledge of the oral Torah is the life force of the Jewish people. Okay? This is something which can never, ever be underestimated. This was the amazing contribution of Rabbeinu HaKodesh. Only a person of his inspiration, his stature, first of all, he was something very, very radical, and only someone like him could have taken this. It was radical. He did something which ostensibly is forbidden to do, to write down the oral law. But Rabbi understood he was divinely inspired. Again, don't do things that you can do. Okay?
We got to do it.
Okay? Rabbi was certainly vindicated because he produced the work, which is the mainstay of the Jewish people to this very day. The Mishnah, of course, after a while, in subsequent generations, already was just not enough. It needed a greater expansion. And so immediately after Rabbi, the next stage is already going to begin, where they're going to start working on the Gemara itself, the Talmud itself, this is going to commence already in the generations after Rabbi. Okay? But this is the monumental contribution. I'll just finish up, maybe I'll just give you, next time I'll just give you a little bit. It says like this: there are two opinions when Rabbi actually completed it. One point to one opinion, it was 120 years after the destruction. According to another opinion, it's 150 years after the destruction. And it comes out like this: it says that 1,530 years after Mount Terra, right? It was, yeah, this is what an opinion over here, that Rebbe was already 1,530 years after the beginning of the Torah. It was 530 years after Shimon HaTzadik, who was the first of the chain of the great Tannaim of these sages. 150 years after the destruction, Rebbe succeeded in forging in the Mishnah to hold the body of the oral law into six bodies with a fixed language that was accepted by the entire Jewish people. Yeah? And the authentic first of our take given by Mishnah. And this really was before the end of the period of the Mishnah. After Rebbe, he couldn't be, these teachings could not be added to, it has to come on to right now, the beginning of a new period of Talmudic learning. But Rebbe has made an absolutely life-saving contribution to the Jewish people. He is, like the Gemara says, he is an agent of the divine providence to produce such a thing which is contained. Jewish people, so that's very, 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 very